Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
Rob is here to talk about music from the 80s.
Has there been any music since then?
All right, it's Tuesday. Tuesday here on Rockin' the Suburbs. We were just talking about movies, but now we're going to get back to music.
Could be Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, very nice. Nicely done. We'll get to that here in just a moment. We're talking about 80s music, but specifically how classic rock artists adapted to the 80s. This was Rob's idea for a topic. It's a great topic. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Rob Gates.
Kevin Gull.
And as I mentioned yesterday, Patrick Foster is out this week hiking up a mountain or something, doing something absurd like that. Pretty soon we'll get him back down to sea level and drinking as he should be doing. So let's, speaking of drinking, what do we got here? You poured me something else, Kevin.
This is Hoppy Honey is the name of it, and it's from Lost Rhino Brewery, a local brewery. I actually lived on the same floor in my college dormitory with one of the founders. And one of the other co-founders actually lives in my neighborhood. I don't know him, and I didn't keep contact with the guy from college, but I just know these facts about Lost Rhino. Just
all right.
Yep.
Very good to know.
That's all I have to say about that. It's good beer.
Does it help? Does that benefit you in some way, having known these people for way you do?
No, I, like I said, I don't really keep contact. I just saw on Facebook that one of the co-founders lived on the same floor as me, and then the other one lives in my neighborhood.
Okay, well, enjoy that beer. We're going to take a quick flashback to times past, to days of future past.
Nice.
Okay, that is Tuesday Afternoon from the Moody Blues, 1967, from the album Days of Future Past.
Which was a great album.
Yes.
Also featured Knights of White Satin.
That's right.
And all sorts of other weird Moody Blues sounding things.
It is one of those classic albums that for a long time, you know, it was like sort of like one of those essential albums. Like everybody, you had to have this album in your collection if you were any kind of rock fan, right? So, and it had that, they obviously were inspired by the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper. Well, although this was right around the same time as Sgt. Pepper, so I don't know about that. But obviously it has a feeling of that sort of Beatlesque, you know, when the Beatles were turning to psychedelia and that kind of stuff, right?
The same production techniques, I think, yeah.
You know, orchestral. It has different sort of movements. Yeah,
separation.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, how does this relate to the 80s?
Well, it relates to the 80s in the sense that the Moody Blues was another band that had a big hit that seemingly came out of nowhere in the 1980s after They never really went away in the in fact, they had several albums in the 70s and then sort of again in the late 70s sort of tailed off, although I believe they continued to tour.
Their album sales apparently, and I was surprised by this, were always pretty strong through the 70s. And I have to think it was because in the 70s, you had a lot of, you had more sort of album-oriented artists, you know, who weren't necessarily getting hits on the radio anymore, but people would go buy the records because they were so interesting and you could maybe listen with headphones and maybe accentuate the experience with something else, right? I think it sort of, appealed toward a certain segment of listener. But to your point, let me make sure I have this correct. To your point, though, Nights in White Satin was a top 10 hit, although I did not know this until today. It was not a big hit when it was originally released in 1967. It became a big hit on when they re-released it in 1972. So there was something going on. I think the Moody Blues were sort of continuing to build up this following. And, you know, in that sort of era, like I said, when people were getting to more like albums and like, whoa, you know, sort of like, you know, these experiential kind of records and that kind of stuff. The label thought this maybe was a good opportunity to re-release that song. So it was went to number 9 in the U.S. in 1972. But then they didn't have another top 10 single until 1986. Wildest Dreams, as I mentioned, 1986. You guys remember that song?
Yeah. What I find interesting about that song from the Moody Blues is a couple things. First of all, it sounds like they said, we're going to take our formula of, you know, our orchestral arrangements, the long lead in, everything in Tuesday Afternoon is in that song. It's just sped up. And we're also going to use a very poppy, positive major chord structure, as opposed to a lot of their early stuff, which has a lot of minor keys. And Kevin can probably speak to this, but it's like, hey, let's go into the studio, let's do what we've always done, and let's speed it up a little bit, and let's make it a little more poppy. If you think of some of their other stuff that came after Days of Future Past, like Ride My Seesaw, it was a fast song, but still tended to be more minor key.
I mean, I think the other thing is, as you talked about yesterday, too, because of the technology of the 80s, they seem to get this kind of pseudo-orchestral sound, but maybe a little bit more with synthesizers and things like that, as opposed to bringing in a 40-piece orchestra, what they may have done back in the 60s.
Yeah, how many were in the Moody Blues? Because my perception is that it was this huge 40-piece band all the time. That's what it sounded like to me.
Looks like five was the core group. Five guys, yeah.
Interesting.
Now, we got to get to me, what was just a huge comeback. I know, Rob, that you really wanted to talk about this artist here. And let's start with the 80s hit, and then we can work backwards from there.
Mm-hmm.
Fogerty. You remember when that came out?
Oh, yeah.
There has to be a story with that song.
There is. He wrote it during a baseball game while he was watching a baseball game. It's that simple. I learned this last week. No, really.
So, but this actually is one of the more unexpected comebacks. If you put yourself back in that time, because, you know, today everybody's heard that song and you hear it, you go to the ballpark, but it's also just, it's a song that's sort of like etched in everybody's memory. It was such a big, not only kind of a big hit song, but just very memorable, right?
Yeah, you hear it whenever you go to the baseball game.
That's right.
Yeah.
In between innings.
That's true.
But this came out in 1985. It ended up becoming a number one album. And you got to remember that nobody had really heard much from John Fogerty at all since the early 70s. The last CCR album was 1972. He did put out a couple of solo records in the interim, but they were sort of under the radar. I mean, there's a couple of songs on there that you might have heard, but they weren't really necessarily big hit records. And to a large extent, this was because he was having a battle with the record label, the CCR record label, Fantasy Records, and Saul Zance was the label head. And he ended up, because of whatever, contract, getting out of the contract or whatever, ended up signing away all the publishing rights to the Creedence catalog, if you can imagine how valuable that would be. And so for a long time, he wouldn't play any of those songs because he didn't want to give this guy any money. So imagine that, like basically saying, like, I wrote this huge catalog of hit songs and now I'm not going to perform them, right? And he just kind of laid low for the most part for quite a while, to the point where I can't even imagine this, the record label who put out Center Field thought this was going to be a hit, because Fogerty recorded it completely solo. He played all the instruments himself. It was a very DIY sort of thing. Again, sort of very sort of under the radar, underground, and then put it out. And it ended up, as I said, being a number one album. It was. I remember this. I was in high school then, and it was a huge record.
Sure.
Yeah.
You said that was 85?
Yeah.
When did Brothers in Arms come out and have the Walk of Life?
Right around
the baseball theme. Wouldn't that been about 85?
Right, yeah. Around the same time.
Yeah, I think so. Or the year after.
So I remember
it was in heavy rotation 85. In 86.
What was going on with baseball in that year? We should probably look that up.
I didn't know that Walk of Life was about baseball.
Is it not?
I don't
know
if it's about baseball, but remember they had a video that had a bunch of sports scenes in
okay,
it.
Okay, so maybe I'm confusing. There so you go, the MTV.
Yeah, it became kind of a sports anthem of sorts at the time, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember it being about baseball.
It may have been.
Which walks and baseball. Make sense. Do they play baseball in England?
Never made that connection.
Yeah.
The thing about Center Field and that whole album is John Fogerty's voice.
Yes.
Like Steve Winwood, did not change.
That's right.
I mean, it is unchanged. Roy Orbison, who we also spoke about yesterday, you know, his voice clearly changed through that. You can hear it, but Fogerty.
Yeah,
it's that same Creedence driving, very distinctive voice, and you could see Creedence doing that song.
Well, what was the Creedence song you wanted to play just for comparison's sake?
Run Through the Jungle.
Oh, good choice.
Oh, I thought it was a nightmare.
So the reason why I wanted to play that, it's a Vietnam protest song.
Right.
It's a very angry song. Whereas we have Center Field, which is about baseball, and it's very happy.
Right.
And then we're, you know, we go back 20 years and, you know, we're back into Vietnam and protest songs. And a lot of these, when I looked into a lot of these comebacks, a lot of the earlier versions from the various bands tended to be a lot more angry.
Oh, yeah.
The songs tend to be a lot more angry than the 80s versions. And if we remember the 80s were very carefree and there was new wave and there wasn't a lot going on to protest. And if you look at, you know, there's some other bands that we'll speak about later in this week, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, very angry.
Right.
In some of their songs. The Who is also that way.
Right.
I thought one of the things, Fogerty, and a lot of the Creedence stuff tends to be sort of a little bit darker, a little bit more angry.
Yeah. Funny that you mentioned that song, because the other weird thing about the Center Field album was that, and I mentioned the legal battles that he had been in for years with Saul Zance at Fantasy Records. After Center Field became a big hit, the album, he got sued by Saul Zance for plagiarizing himself. Do you guys familiar with this?
I do remember that.
It was for Run Through the Jungle, which we just heard, and the hit song on the Center Field album called The Old Man Down the Road. So listen to this. So remember that song we just heard, and now listen to this. Saul Zance felt that that song sounded too similar to Run Through the Jungle.
I didn't hear it.
No?
No.
Maybe.
Maybe the style of playing.
If you were looking for it.
Yeah. I don't know. He actually took him to court, and John Fogerty got on the stand and actually demonstrated on his guitar how the songs are different.
Interesting.
And he won. Yep. Fogerty won.
Good for him.
Yeah. So, but again, you know, I think nobody expected, of all people, to have sort of a huge hit album in the mid-80s with John Fogerty. And you mentioned, Rob, his voice sounded the same, but even like really, for the most part, the musical style, you know, the instrumentation, the arrangements, all that kind of stuff, that sort of swampy guitar sound, all of that was pretty much the same too. It's not like he, like some other artists, you know, it's not like Fogerty tried to adapt a new sound for the modern times. He just came out and just did what he does.
I had a friend in high school who would say, oh, there's John Fogerty, the guy who does not age.
Yeah. He's still out there playing. I saw him a few years ago and he was great. All right, there was one more we wanted to talk about on this episode. Are you waving over your significant other? No, she's waving you back. All right. She's
behind the scenes.
Left a good job down in the city. Working for the man every night and day. And I never lost 1 minute of sleep.
And I was worrying
about the way that things might have been.
You know that
big wheel keep on turning. Primary keep on burning. And we're rolling.
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 Rolling
on a river. hitched a ride on the riverboat queen. Big wheel keep on turning. Proud Mary keep on burning. And we're rolling.
Rolling.
Rolling, yeah.
Rolling.
Rolling on a river.
On the river.
Say we're rolling.
That was, of course, Ike and Tina Turner, 1971, and they, you know, as you heard there, they were a big time, like, soul review kind of a band, you know, and very much of that time, just coming out with a lot of power, a great stage show, just, you know, tremendous energy, all of that. And then they, I don't want to say this, they had some trouble. And they ended up going through a very messy divorce, and Ike is not a good guy. Let's just say that. And he not good to Tina, and also you know, had a drug problem and all kinds of stuff. And so, but what I did not know until doing a little bit of research here was that Tina really got a bad deal in the divorce too, and she had to sign over a lot of her rights to their music. And so she it was a long and messy situation, and when she got out of that, she didn't really have much of a career of her own. She was kind of left in kind of a bad spot, and it took her quite a while to kind of build up a new career. And then, boom, she releases this album called Private Dancer in 1984. And it was an enormous hit.
Am I right?
Yep, 1984. And it was an enormous hit. To the point where it went 5 times platinum. That's how big of a hit album that was. But, so definitely a big comeback. I mean, people talk about the Tina Turner comeback all the time and how happy they were for her and how she was this kind of, you know, symbol of female empowerment and being able to sort of, you know, get out of this bad situation and take control of her life and build a new life and career out of that.
So had she not done anything prior to that?
She had a couple of solo records before Private Dancer, but they didn't really, you know, nothing really came of it, right?
Right. Until Thunderdome.
And she also was in, she also, before the divorce though, she had a little bit of a solo success with Acid Queen from Tommy.
Oh, right? Yes. Oh,
right.
Right.
You are right.
That was kind of a thing for her. But anyway, this, I think this Private Dancer and this comeback and her success really meant a lot to a lot of people. But she definitely went with a different sound, kind of like the opposite of the John Fogerty thing. She went really with like more of a 80s pop sound versus the, you know, kind of like the late 60s, early 70s soul music that she was doing. So for instance, well, you mentioned Thunderdome. That wasn't on the Private Dancer album, but the Private Dancer success led to that. So here you go. Play this for Rob.
Children
I didn't see that movie. That was another movie I maybe have only seen bits and pieces of.
I'm sure I did.
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Yeah. Is she singing about Mad Max in there or Ike?
Well,
let's not go there.
Yeah.
I've saw that many times.
And I've never seen it. I've never seen any of the Mad Max movies.
Well, you've got some work to do.
All right.
Yes. But that does, that song did sound a lot like What's Love Got to Do with It?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
She definitely leaned into the sort of like 80s
ballad-ish
kind of thing with the, you know, those kind of dancing synthesizers and that kind of stuff, right? By the way, the song Private Dancer, I did not know this till today in doing some research. The song Private Dancer, which was another big hit for her, was actually written by Mark Knopfler.
Uh-huh.
That's,
well, is that?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Bizarre. He wrote it, and it was supposed to be on a Dire Straits album, and then he was sort of like, you know, why did I write this song? It doesn't quite sound right for a man to be singing this song. So he gave it to Tina.
Oh, there we go.
The other thing I think is interesting, too, is because she had a reputation of being embraced by, you know, sort of like the rock and roll crowd, to the point even where in the 80s, she had another big hit duet from somebody who had just emerged in the 80s, and that would have been Bryan Adams. So we will play out with that. I'm going to dispense with all the closing business. We'll get back tomorrow with more classic rock bands and their successes in the 80s. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Rob Gates.
Kevin Goff.
And this is Tina Turner and Bryan Adams with their hit song, It's Only Love.
It's about baseball.